I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
You and I have had some health challenges lately as lurgies have floated around Fremantle, but we're both on deck again today.
We are. I think it's a product of winter. I think these things come around a bit more often. I get a few from the kids too sometimes, Michael.
Well, one thing is for sure, lurgies don't seem to stop international politics, national politics, local politics. The lurgies are just ignored when it comes to that. We were railing or starting to rail about US imports of beef a few weeks ago, Martin, but over 6,000 people have read my article on Fremantle Shipping News. Who will buy US grain-fed beef anyway? It's
Yeah.
amazing. I don't think we need to worry about it anymore. The Jill Siegel recommendations to the federal government about anti-Semitism seem to have fallen off the back of a truck or got lost in a dark room, have become irrelevant since the Palestinian state question took centre stage, it seems, Martin. And of course, we've got the international tariff situation going on, although that is used just as a political weapon, and we'll perhaps come back to that in a moment as we talk about Palestine as well. But there's a real danger all of these things will fall completely by the wayside, Martin, because the AFL final few home and away games will trump all of them over the next few weeks, don't you think?
Oh, well, nothing gets in the way of the road train that is the AFL finals, Michael.
On top of that, of course, everyone's going to be waiting to see whether the Russians, Putin in particular, responds to the, well, it must be down to about a 7-day call from Trump for action on Ukraine. What do you make of all of that? Martin, we live in interesting times.
I think we do. And the thing about Trump that's interesting is he links a lot of them too. You know, we've talked to, we're going to brush on the, certainly going to discuss the Palestinian conflict. There's some sense or worry that in some countries that their actions on that might jeopardise trade with the US. So Trump does mix up some of these different geopolitical issues, doesn't he?
When I was a lad and even older, Martin, the idea that you would use tariffs as a weapon in sort of geopolitics and dealing with particular countries, even your friends and your allies like Australia, was sort of beyond the pall. But perhaps it was always the case.
Oh, I don't think it's new. I think various countries have used trade as weapons. Even the Venetians did to great effect during the Renaissance, Michael. They used that very prodigiously. So it's it goes right back to the ancient times. It's not new. It probably hasn't been used as a blunt instrument or a naked power instrument as openly as Trump's used it, but it's been used more subtly, perhaps, in recent times too.
Well, I mean, what do you make of the current tariff situation?
Well, I think that Trump is the deal maker, and that's what he wants to do. And his sense is that either you make a deal with me or I slap some higher tariffs on you. And I make a deal with me, so you, I make a deal with you so that it's evident the benefit that the US is deriving from these deals. That's his broader strategy. Of course, he's got to manage a range of other things going on as well. The domestic response to this, I don't think that's been that helpful for him at the moment. And that's all before these tariffs really, really hit. Once they start hitting, and a number of them have been delayed, but once the bigger tariffs start hitting on basic, I think that will put a different pressure strain on him altogether.
And then Australia, of course, in this funny position. I mentioned beef. We're letting some US grain-fed beef in. We're also trying to do this huge AUKUS deal with the US and the UK. We've had the UK ministers here recently and big military war games off Darwin. It looks like, you know, it's the good old days back into the 40s and 50s, Martin, when Australia and the UK were the big allies and US is on the outer. It all seems a bit odd to me.
Well, the 1940s was this seminal shift during World War II for all of our students of history, where we had previously relied heavily on the UK. The fall of Singapore demolished that myth that they were going to look after us. We looked to the East and the US. The US helped us and helped turn back the Japanese tide during World War II. And since that time, we've looked to the US for security. But with Trump's various activities and his different directions, I think that's actually pushed us back towards the UK, ironically. And it seems that a number of our senior government ministers are meeting with UK ministers, apparently Albanese and Keir Starmer, talk quite frequently. And I think that we'll probably see a common, some common agenda items internationally with the UK more than the US at the moment.
Well, we'll watch it with great interest. We've talked and commented many times, the entire world has been, about the situation of women, children, people, innocent ones dying, being killed in Gaza. And there does seem to be outrage right around the world. Of course, many Israelis, but not all, say, oh, they started it back a couple of years ago in the October attack and the murders that happened. But others are saying, well, that's fine, and we accept that, and it's terrible, and we consider it reprehensible, but you can't continue to keep starving people the way you're doing it. And now you have France, UK, Canada, other countries wanting to recognize the state of Palestine as a way of responding to this and trying to advance geopolitics. There are conditions that have been laid down. We've got France who led the charge recently. How different are the approaches of those three leading European-based countries?
There are some significant differences. So France led the charge. France has basically said, we are going to recognise a Palestinian state. UK and then Canada have come out in what might seem like similar vein, but there is actually some differences. They're talking about recognising a Palestinian state under strict conditions. And those conditions are actually quite significant. One is that that there's a ceasefire and that a peace settlement. One is that that Hamas has no role in the governance of Gaza. Big stipulation given everything we've got on at the moment. And governance assurances, they're expecting that as well. So there's fairly significant preconditions that they have for establishing a Palestinian state. And I think that if Australia were to go down the right that path, I'd expect they'd have a similar view to the UK or Canada.
Martin, we have touched on these topics in the past. I mean, the whole question of the governance of Gaza beyond a peace settlement is an enormous challenge. Apart from anything else, and you've raised this in the past, how do the countries that are neighbouring Israel and Gaza, the new Palestinian state, we would assume, react to all of this? I mean, how do you start to unpack it? How can you imagine the situation being, let's just say, 50 years into a new Palestinian state?
I think this is the big unresolved question because the blunt reality is at the moment in the Gaza Strip, to the extent that Gaza has a government, and bear in mind its capacity has been degraded incredibly, it is an organisation that's terror listed. There's listed as a terror organisation in these same countries that are talking about a Palestinian state. So clearly there's incongruence. They can't accept that Hamas will run a state that they're recognising at the same time. Have them listed in that fashion. So they do have to put really strict conditions around it, but it's completely unresolved at the moment. The Palestinian Authority that people point to as potential governor, they have very little reach and jurisdiction even in the West Bank. They're often regarded as corrupt. I think I saw a poll, I don't know how accurate it is, where their popularity in the West Bank that they're supposed to be governing is about 8%, Michael. So there's just who is around. I think the only solution would be in the interim or short term, there's some kind of peacekeeping force or governance provided by other nations, potentially others in the region. But that's highly complicated too, because Hamas has been widely regarded as a proxy of Iran. So is Iran going to accept Qatar and Saudi Arabia going in there? I don't think so. Saudi Arabia going to accept Iran going? Of course not. There's so many unanswered questions around that, and a state does need governance issues resolved. So it's a very complex matter.
Martin, having always been interested in international affairs amongst other matters, national and state politics as well, I'm able to remember periods when individuals and organisations were considered, like Hamas is now considered, terrorists, never to be spoken to. And yet people like Yasser Arafat with the Palestinian Liberation Organisation, he finishes off going, I think, to the Oslo Accords. He's welcomed at Camp David. He became a figure. And when I was caught up in the peace demonstrations, Martin, as an anti-Vietnam moratorium demonstrator, Ho Chi Minh and the whole people against whom South Vietnam and the Americans and the Australians were fighting were considered terrorists. They were considered people who were just going to cause a domino to start crashing all the way down to Australia. We eventually came to understand that there are liberation fights going on here. This is, in many ways, can be seen as very post-colonial. Is it not some way forward where the Hamases of the world are in fact integrated? We're seeing the new Syrian leader, Martin, who apparently was part of IS. What's happening?
No, you make an excellent point. And it's often fascinating developments happen down the track. And people that are terrorists are later seen, perhaps as freedom fighters. In this matter of October the 7th, I think that is a real stumbling block because certainly Israel would never accept Hamas being involved in government again. But I think that there's a dim view of that particular attack that's fairly broadly held in the West as well. Now, whether that's a permanent ongoing impediment, I suspect that's it. It's a little bit similar to Al-Qaeda being accepted by the US. I'm not quite sure. I think that could be a bridge too far. But clearly, there needs to be a sustainable long-term solution there.
Well, I mean, I've never understood why. Well, I suppose I do. When you ask the question, the answer's perhaps obvious. Why Hamas don't release all the hostages? From what we're being told, 50-odd number of them are dead. Why don't they just provide it all? The simple answer seems to be it's somehow some sort of bargaining chip.
I think that's how they see it, effectively, that this is their last bargaining chip. It's the only thing that might restrain Israel in any way, shape, or form. And they don't want to give up that bargaining chip. And it might be something that they can bring to the table in some kind of settlement. Of course, managing those 50 hostages must be incredibly difficult anyway, I would have thought. And quite a few of them died during the conflict. So it would also be logistically increasingly difficult for them as well. But the part that really troubles me, Michael, is I think that there's a lot of vested interests on both sides of this conflict in keeping it going. So in Hamas's case, a proper peace settlement might make them redundant. And for Netanyahu, a proper peace settlement paves the way for questions about his conduct during the war and other corruption inquiries. So this is the part that troubles me. I think that there's too much at stake sometimes for the political and military elites to give up, to actually pull back.
And there's a whole question of disarming, you've mentioned. I mean, I sort of puzzled and amazed daily after a couple of years of this battle between Israel and Hamas, and the number of people who continue to be killed, and the guns still being fired on both sides, that Hamas have any left, that they continue to be able to pull out armaments.
Look, one thing I think that one thing that but none of us have easy solutions, Michael. But if that one thing that certainly needs to happen immediately, and even Donald Trump would concede this, is food and medical support needs to get into Gaza en masse. And if there were some concerns that Hamas was sort of commandeering this, the only solution to counter that would be to provide it in such numbers that it doesn't become an inflatable commodity to pressure people with. So if you flooded the Gaza Strip with food and medication. It doesn't change the situation militarily, but it would actually make a massive difference to the ordinary civilian population. And I don't see how we would necessarily advantage Hamas either.
During the week, human rights group in Israel came out and condemned what's happening in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli Defense Force as indeed amounting to genocide.
And I think this is part of also what has been the stimulus for the Western governments. They certainly see the recognizing of Palestinian statehood as a means of getting Israel to the table. I think that's particularly Macron, and he's because his statement of intent in doing it directly linked to that, and he expressed his frustration at the current set of circumstances.
Martin, the thing that I also can't believe is the level of destruction. Most of the Gaza Strip, from the photographs you see, from both up above and below, and from what Jeremy Bowen, the famous BBC correspondent, said on video on the news the other night, looking down from the plane when he went in while they were doing food drops, there's nothing there. The place is flattened. You're going to need something bigger than the Marshall Plan after the Second World War to make Gaza anything like whole again. I mean, how does one do it?
Oh, that would be an extraordinary challenge, but first and foremost, it's food and medical support into Gaza. It's a ceasefire. It's return of hostages, and it's some form of peace. Unless you have a peace settlement that actually lasts, how can you do any of these things? If it's just short-term ceasefires, no one's going to be rebuilding the whole area and providing homes for people, are they? They're only going to do that once there's actually a proper peace settlement.
Well, Martin, in times of war and leading up to war, of course, the companies, private companies usually, you can look at them in relation to the Second World War, both in Germany, the US, other places, make a lot of money making guns and cannons and bullets and things, helmets sometimes, and the same in peace. You then have to bring in often the same companies with different names on them to rebuild what's been destroyed by what they created as weapons of war. I mean, where would the aid come from? Australian companies, no doubt, would be bidding for these multi-billion dollar contracts to go in and build new social and affordable housing, Martin.
I think if there was actually a proper and acceptable peace solution in the here, that you would have a number of Western countries that would step up and say, we really do feel the responsibility to help out here. So I think that the aid would come. I think that the investment would come, but they need to be confident that this is a really lasting solution, because otherwise it might be money down the drain.
Oh, you know, we can sit here in the comfort of Fremantle, where everything seems to work most of the time, and you can wring your hands over this, and people say, well, yeah, you're not on the ground there, you've got no idea what this is about, just how bad Hamas are. But then, as we see, people around Australia are rising up to support the creation of a Palestinian state. What do you think we're going to be seeing, say, in 6 months' time, the end of the year, perhaps, as we go on the parliamentary Christmas break in Canberra? What will the state of affairs be?
Oh, look, I'm not that optimistic. The best I think is the most we might expect is that there is a ceasefire in place, some kind of ceasefire in place. I'm not so optimistic as to expect an actual peace deal. That would still be better than what we have at the moment. Still be a step forward. But yeah, I wish I was wrong. But everything we've seen. I mean, we were here last year talking about the same thing, weren't we? And not a lot's changed.
All right, well, on that, I won't call it an entirely pessimistic note. We'll bring this view from the roundhouse to a close, Martin, but we know what we're going to be talking about next week. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We're going to be talking about Trump and Putin. Got any predictions?
Well, it's coming up to D-Day, isn't it, for Putin to do something about this? I think the penny's finally dropped, maybe for Donald Trump, that Putin might make nice noises when he talks to him, but actually his actions on the ground have not reflected his sentiments to Trump. And I think it was 305 drones this morning attacked Kiev. So it's just the bombardment is extraordinary there. And you can see Trump's impatience. But what levers is he prepared to pull?
Well, listeners, tune in next Friday morning, the Fremantle time, to View from the Roundhouse with Professor Martin Drum, and some of the answers to that question will be provided. Martin, thanks for joining me today.
A pleasure as always.